We are in our final summer OUJLIC Shirko on the Parsha. Our series ended up being a series on Sefer Bamidbar, and though we are technically in Parsha Devarim, we divided Parshiot Matot and Maaseh in order to give them their equal importance and to give each of them a full shiur. So we're going to finish, we're going to learn Parshat Maaseh this week, learn about it, try to see if we can figure out how everything comes together in Parshat Maaseh, and also again how all of Sefer Bamidbar comes to its conclusion in the context of Parshat Maaseh. So before we even jump into the Parsha, let's remind ourselves, we've been learning together all summer. We've been learning Sefer Midrash together all summer, Baruch Hashem. So let's go back and just remind ourselves of some of the key themes, the major themes that took us throughout Sefer Bamidbar that have to somehow come to their conclusion, be wrapped up, tied together in the context of this final Parsha, Parshat Maaseh and Sefer Bamidbar. The main theme that we focused on came from actually the name that Chazal gives to Bamidbar, which is Chumash HaPikudim. Chumash HaPikudim, which we talked about how it's the book of counting, that's literally what it means, not the book of numbers, but the book of counting, because there are two countings in the Sefer, a counting in Parshat Bamidbar and a counting in Parshat Pinchas, a counting of the generation that becomes known as the Dor HaMidbar, the Yotzei Mitzrayim, as opposed to the Dor Ba'ei HaAretz. That divide happens over the course of our Sefer, but we have these two countings. But even more so, we talked about the significance of counting, that it gives rise to the individual person as a part of that individual Shevet, which then needs its unique makom. And so much of Sefer Midbar revolves around the rise of the individual, the uniqueness of the individual, as opposed to all other Svarim and Chumash, certainly up until this point. And also focusing very much on what Makoma means, the link, the inherent link between one's identity and the space that they fill, the space that they're given, whether it's in the context of Sefer Midbar, whether it's around the Machaneh Shechinah, around the Mishkan, or as we look forward at the end of Sefer Midbar toward Eretz Yisrael, the place within Eretz Yisrael that each person and each Shevet is going to have. That was one piece. Another theme that we actually haven't discussed, oddly, pretty much at all, is the actual pshat name of the Sefer, which is Sefer Bamidbar. We've avoided that almost. It's been lurking underneath the surface without going into it too much now, just to note kind of where it's come and how it's come up. What is a Midbar? What is it literally?
A desert.
A desert. What exists in a desert?
Nothing.
Nothing. It's a place of nothingness. It's a place of no yeshuv. It's a place that lacks any sense of identity. It's a place that creates the possibility for an identity to rise by being a place that's totally, you take away all the noise of the yeshuv, you take away all the noise that comes in from having a previously settled place with its preconceived notions, with its preconceived societal norms, with its preconceived structures, and allows the possibility to give rise to a new thing, to a new faith, to something new, which is each individual or Klal Yisrael as a whole. And that was way too short to really give it justice, but it really has been underlying so much of what we've talked about over the course of these parshiot. And additionally, the Midbar is also a place, Mary points this out, that it's a place where, because there's no yeshuv, it's a place of nothingness, that if something wants to really change, change oneself, to change in a certain way, so you can't always necessarily so simply go from being one way to another way. That the way, one of the primary ways you can create change is that what do you have to do first before you can become something else?
Accept who you are.
Hafuch. Remove your previous identity. Meaning, I am a certain way now, I have to remove that, get that out of the way, and only then, in the new space that I've created, can I give rise to that new identity, which ends up being, almost foreshadowing in a very sad way, what very literally happens to Bnei Yisrael in the context of the desert, which is that one generation which can't get rid of its preconceived notions is washed away, is wiped away, and on the background of the Midbar, this new identity of Klal Yisrael is able to come forth from this lack of identity of the world, and it's a new identity is able to be formed that's unique and unto itself. So again, that deserves a shiur of its own, which in like a midrashah setting would probably have happened as another shiur in Parsha Bamidbar. We focus on the Chumash Pekudim aspect, but that theme's also been underneath the surface over all of our discussions in Sefer Midbar. And we'll swing back to the word Bamidbar, we'll be discussing it way more in depth toward the end of Shir today. But those are kind of the big themes. Some, there are a few other ones, but some of the big themes that we've really been addressing. And so all of them somehow must come to their conclusion in this concluding parsha of Parshat Mas'eh. So all we don't have a source sheet today, all we have are Chumashim in front of us. Let's take a look in the Chumashim that we have at the Parsha, Parshat Mas'eh, and let's identify the major topics of the Parsha, which this Parsha actually has a relatively clear and flowing narrative. But let's identify those topics, and let's draw them together to start off. So what do we have in Parshat Mas'eh, which all of you are clearly familiar with because you all read last week as Parshat Shavua. So what do we have in Mas'eh?
The travels.
Good. The first thing we have is the actual journeys. Mm-hmm. The whole list of the journeys. That's the first long, long topic in Parshat Mas'eh. Page 918 in your Chumashim that are in front of you starts it off in Perek Lamed Gimel of Sefer Bamidbar. So that takes us all the way through a nice big chunk of the Parsha. And then we shift gears in Perek Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Nun. What starts happening there?
They're supposed to drive out the Canaanites.
Good. We have the command to destroy and to wipe out, to push out all of the nations in Canaan. After we have the command to push out all of the nations from Eretz Canaan, what then comes forth? The actual boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. Good. Then?
How to inherit Canaan.
Say again?
The way that they're going to inherit Canaan. Like who's...
Be more specific. Good. Get there. Who's what?
The Nesim from each Shevet.
Good. The leaders of each Shevet who will be involved in the division of that land. Leaders of each Sheva for the purpose of dividing the land. Then we have... Good. We have the designation of the 48 cities of the Levim, which leads us into a discussion of the... Good. The Arei Miklat. And then our last and final topic of Sefer Bamidbar, which... Sefer Bamidbar comes to a close.
The end of the story of Benot Tzlafchat?
Right, that's how it's usually known. Right? The other half of that story that started a while ago, which somehow ended up here, and we're going to have to clearly deal with that as the final chord of Sefer Bamidbar. What is it doing here? Why does it have to finish off? And even just the fact that we refer to it as such, like there's this presumption, like it's the other half of that story from there that somehow ended here, and it's not clear why. Just dealing with the issue of intermarriage between Shvatim. Intermarriage between the Shvatim. Well, that's how it's looked at, meaning the conclusion is don't do it. The conclusion of that story is to not allow intermarriage between the Shvatim, and we'll talk about that as well. Let's discuss these and really kind of... we'll be able to tackle most of them very quickly, and I want to then really get to that last topic, which is concludes the concluding parsha and should really be wrapping everything together. So the first thing we have is the journeys of Bnei Yisrael. Now, while it's still unclear to me, and there is a lot of Torah discussed about this, but there's still a lot of lack of clarity, at least on my part, why we need to go through and name each and every single one of the journeys at length for 50 psukim all throughout the beginning of Parshat Bamidbar, in terms of how it wraps up Sefer Bamidbar, well, that's sort of right there and in our faces, right? Meaning Sefer Bamidbar is the book of Bamidbar. Very literally, it's the book of the desert, and so we begin the concluding parsha by reviewing every single one of our stops in the context of that Midbar. Whatever happened in the Midbar happened on all of these journeys, and this is the journey of Sefer Midbar, so we go through all of the stops that we make on that journey in the desert. That journey comes to a conclusion on our Avot Moav, Al Yarden Yerecho. We come to the border of Eretz Yisrael, at which point we then need the next piece, which is the command to go forward and wipe out the nations that are there so we can inherit Eretz Yisrael. But how do we know who to wipe out? How far do we go? So what do? We define what is Eretz Yisrael. We have to give it boundaries, meaning we have to go forward and wipe out the people who are inside of that land. Well, what is that land? So we go through the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael to know what it is that we're going to fight for, to conquer, and to inherit. But if the last part of that sentence was, and to inherit, we're going to need individuals who are going to be in charge of inheriting Eretz Yisrael. Which very much also, meaning if this was almost drawing together, if the journey zone was drawing together a certain level of the Bamidbar aspect of Sefer Bamidbar, then this brings together really the other aspects of Bamidbar, the Chumash Pekudim part of Sefer Bamidbar, which is that the goal of Sefer Bamidbar is to get us to the board of Eretz Yisrael, and then designating the individual people, right? That's what's happening here. We're designating the individual people from each individual Shevet that will be in charge of inheriting the individual Nachalot of Eretz Yisrael. Individuals from individual Shvatim to be given specific and unique Mekomot. Pure Sefer Bamidbar. And that's really where all of this is leading to and bringing itself together. So that theme really also does very clearly wrap itself up within the context of 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, and 4. And 5 to a certain extent, because what comes next is the designation of the cities of the Levim. Now that always happens, meaning if you go all throughout Sefer Midbar, whenever we talk about the context of identifying the unique elements of Klal Yisrael and talking about who they are, where they are, who their leaders are, where they're going to settle around the Mishkan and Eretz Yisrael, so the Levim are always off to the side. They're never part of the countings, they're never part of the classic Machanot, they're never part of the classic settling of Eretz Yisrael. They are set aside because they are unique, as we saw the rise of the Levim completely in Parshat Korach. Clear that they are on their own place, in their own level. It's very clearly Shevet Levi. It's very clearly through Aaron HaKohen that the Kohanim are coming out. So Levi is always dealt with separately, and so too here. Levi is dealt with separately, and we need to give the Makom for Levi as well. So that fits also in terms of the next place. And if we're going to be giving all of the spaces that Levi is going to inhabit within the context of Eretz Yisrael, part of that is the Arei Miklat. 6 of those 48 cities are the Arei Miklat. So we have to mention the Arei Miklat in this context. That was 1 through 6. We did pretty good. Right? And this really, again, bringing all of these themes and all of these concepts and really the story of Sefer Bamidbar really bringing it to a close as we stand there on the border of Eretz Yisrael and looking to come in. I want to propose the following just before we shift gears to the last segment of this parsha where we'll be spending the bulk of our time. I actually take issue with the Arei Miklat. Everything until the Arei Miklat makes sense to me. However, in the presentation of the cities of the Levi'im in the fifth part of Sefer of Parshat Mas'ei, it tells you what the Arei Miklat are. If you want, we can even see it inside together. Take a look. So that paragraph starts in Perek Lamed Hei Pasuk Aleph, Perek Lamed Hei Pasuk Aleph, where we're told that we have to separate cities for the Levi'im. And in that context, lo and behold, next page, Pasuk Vav, Ve'atarim asher titnu la'Levi'im et sheish arei ha'miklat asher titnu lanus shama harotzeach. And on top of that, another 42 cities. So what is an Arei Miklat? What is it? What is it? What does the Pasuk here tell us that it is?
It's part of the Arei Miklat.
What is it, though? Why is it unique? What is it uniquely? What does it do? What's the function of an Arei Miklat that the Pasuk can present right here in Pasuk Vav?
A refuge.
It's a city of refuge. It's a city for somebody, if somebody accidentally murders someone. So it's a place for the murderer to run to. Do I know what that means? No. But do I care in Sefer Bamidbar what that means? Not really. Not really. The only reason we're talking about the Levi'im here is because everybody needs their Chelek and Nachalah in Eretz Yisrael, and part of the Chelek and Nachalah of Shevet Levi is the Arei Miklat. So note that it's there. Okay, fine. Note the fact that it's for a Rotzeach, an unintentional murderer, to run to. Note that, and then swing back to it sometime later, which is only emphasized by the fact that we do come back to it later. So then really, what's the point? Because later on in Sefer Devarim, in Parshat Shoftim, we then go over all of the laws of the Arei Miklat. making it even more superfluous to then go. It's not even in the same paragraph. Go, there's a parsha, Ptucha, starting with Pasuk Tet, where then it actually goes, and in its own separate parsha, parshia, its own separate paragraph, goes through all the details of the Yer Miklat. So I think, speaking from my own thinking here in this parsha, again, there was very little material for me to work with, very much spending time thinking out what's going on here in Parshat Maaseh, I don't think it's so obvious that Yer Miklat belongs here. I think that if it would have just said that one pasuk in the last paragraph, that it's where Rotzeach runs to, great, we know what it's in Yer Miklat is, we'll get to it later in its context, in Parshat Shoftim, in Sefer Devarim, we'll deal with it later. But the fact that the Torah goes out of its way to give us psukim upon psukim about what a Yer Miklat is, a huge chunk of this parsha, indicates to me, I suspect, that it must be here for a different reason. It is somehow, again, necessary to wrap up the essence of what Sefer Midbar is about. I suspect it's here for a few reasons. First of all, and we'll spend a few minutes on this before, again, jumping to that last piece. First of all, the Arei Miklat are established as a place of refuge for someone who accidentally kills someone else. So I think the Torah is emphasizing here through the Arei Miklat is how important and significant each individual life is. That's what's happening in this parsha. That's what the emphasis is here in this parsha. And this is both true in the ramifications of taking a life, even by accident, Rahman al-Itzlan, as well as the lengths we go to in order to protect the individual who took that life. How serious it is to take a life, and how much we even value the person who accidentally killed someone else. This whole paragraph is focusing on the uniqueness of each individual. The Arei Miklat are the epitome of how much we value each individual life in Klal Yisrael. How much care has to be taken to protect it. How severe it is to take a life, to take lightly taking a life. And how we even value the life of a murderer himself. And that, I think, here is really surfacing the uniqueness of the individual. Furthermore, so we talked about that I've been using, one of the svarim that I've been using to help guide me through my investigations into Midbar is the Or Gedaliahu. So the Or Gedaliahu, in his section on Parshiot Matot Maaseh, the whole thing I think is a whopping 2.5 pages long. So he has one little piece on Parshat Maaseh. So borrowing, he presents a very short idea there, so I'm borrowing definitely concepts that he presents. He gives the groundwork for it, but taking what he said a little bit further, I think it also is emphasizing the following. When a person kills someone else, Rahman al-Itzlan, lo aleinu, when a person ends up and is an unintentional murderer, the very identity of that person changes. That person becomes a murderer. Before they were not, and now they are. He becomes a murderer, even unintentionally, and he has taken a person out of this world, out of his makom. He's removed somebody from their makom in this world. As a response to this, since he has removed somebody else from their makom, and since he himself now has a whole new identity as a murderer, the murderer himself now needs an entirely new makom. Because makom is always linked to identity, and when one does something as severe as killing somebody else, their whole identity changes, and their makom changes as well. And that's why we need to establish a new place for the new makom of somebody whose identity changes. Emphasizing that while one does have a unique makom in this world, if one changes their identity, their makom changes as well. We have it on the flip side, in the positive way. The concept in Chazal of Mishaneh Makom, Mishaneh Mazal. Right? That there's what a person's place is linked to where they are and where they're at on both sides, whether they change the Makom or they change their identity. This person, having lowered himself through murder, he has to move to a new Makom of greater loftiness amongst the Levim, and with a greater infusion of Torah from the Levim, who are the ones who spread Torah to all of Klal Yisrael, in order to create a greater sensitivity for the importance of each individual life. That's what they're there to teach him. He shifts his Makom to a place of people who allow him to have space, because they're on a loftier place, they can even contain within that a murderer. And they can create for him, over time, a sensitivity through the eyes of the Torah of the uniqueness of each individual. And that comes from the makom that he's in. And this, again, I think all very much wraps up key themes in Bamidbar. Now, without to go into it, I don't have, this is not, I don't, we'll skip it, it's not developed enough yet. I have in my notes here, it says develop more exclamation points, so we'll leave that out for now.
That's a question.
Yeah.
Doesn't that feel like a positive thing?
What?
Like, he murdered someone, and now he's being moved, so he can kind of be in rehab and learn how to...
I mean, I don't think anybody's like, shoot, I'm looking for a vacation. Is there an open rehab center?
Of course not. But
they're separated from their family, from their home, from their people, and they're stuck there until the Kohen Gadol dies. It's a terrible decree on someone. They're totally stuck. And their whole community is a community is like, hey, you who also murdered someone, how are you doing today? Like, it's this colony of accidental murderers who all know that they're there and are stuck there because of this act which stained them so badly that it defines their very reality. So I'd like to think that it's not, you know, a destination spot. I don't think they're Airbnbs in the Arya Miklot.
Do you think, like, the Levium who could choose whichever one of the 48 cities, do you think most of them didn't want to live in those six?
I don't know. I mean, people, it's almost, I don't know if it's a lot deal, but it's almost like, I don't know, there's some people who moved to areas because they wanted to Kiruv. You know, and again, it's only for accidental murderers. This is right. It's not necessarily, you know, it's not a maximum security prison. Right. If the person is an intentional murderer, they're executed. If the person is an accidental murderer, meaning they don't have a sensitivity for human life to the right extent, then these are the people who are going to help these people reform and become members of society that respect the individual. So maybe they dafka wanted to live there. I don't know if they had the choice. I don't understand exactly the mechanics of how it works. But if they did have the choice, it could be that some of them dafka did want to live there. The last thing I want to note about the Arya Miklot, which is, I think, again, this is the second to last paragraph of the Sefer, so it has to bring together all of these themes. But it's odd. You were pointing out, Emily, like I said, you mentioned it was positive. I think it's negative, meaning if there is any way to bring out how beautiful and significant the individual is and how sanctified human life is and how linked up an individual is to their makom, what's the last thing that I would choose about how to do that? Death. If you actually kill somebody, here's what happens. But I think that that's something which we touched upon last week is very much indicative of how all of Bamidbar wraps itself up. Pinchas, and especially Parshiot Matot and Maaseh, when they want to introduce us to new concepts, when they want to introduce us to concepts at all, there's always this very negative flavor, this very destructive flavor that comes out even when trying to prove a point. Why would that be? What did we talk about last week? Somehow, Sefer Bamidbar always is culminating in the 3 weeks. Somehow, the destination of Sefer Bamidbar is in the 3 weeks, is in Ben Hametzarim, is in the Gimel de Poranuta, is in Chorban. And so I suspect here, again, this aspect of the 3 weeks of destruction of Chorban is coming out here, where even in the wrapping up pieces of Sefer Bamidbar, there's this negative flavor and tone to them. We lose Bayit Rishon because of murder and idolatry and adultery. So we have here dealing with issues of murder. So I suspect that that's why this is the context of how the Torah couches it, is because it's coming to emphasize the destructive realities that lead to Chorban. So by the way, as an aside, it's not the only time in this parsha that we deal with issues of Chorban. Even in the previous sections, like when it talks about the command to push out all the other nations from Eretz Canaan, if you take a look at the wrapping up pasuk there, to me it's just not surprising that this is all surfacing during the 3 weeks. The end of that paragraph, Perek Lamid Gimel Pasuk Nun Vav, from Pasuk Nun Hei. Vim lo torish, meaning all because it says just wipe them out, take them out, move them out of the land. But there's a need, because we're in the 3 weeks, for the Torah to surface the negative side of this as well. Vim lo torishu et yoshvei haaretz mitechem, and if you don't drive these nations out of the land, vayash your totiru mehem lisikim beinechem, they will be like thorns in your eyes, litznim etzidechem, and in your sides, vitzararu etchem al haaretz asher atem yoshvim ba, they are going to make your lives miserable in the land, to the point where, concluding pasuk of the inheritance of Eretz Yisrael, very interestingly, of the fact that we're supposed to go and drive out the other nations and then take over that land, dimiti la'asot lahem eselachem, to the point where that which I intend to do them, I will do to you. What is that referring to? What did God intend to do to the people of the Eretz Canaan? Drive them out. That's the topic of this paragraph. Implying here in subtly, it doesn't say it explicitly, but very clearly hinting to, if not, what's going to happen to you? I will drive you out. Chorban. And there are other places in the parsha as well. I think that it's very clearly woven into the fabric of this parsha as somehow there's a level in which the Sefer Bamidbar is almost doomed to conclude in Chorban. That's what I suspect, and something that Rav Amos and I, my Rebbe and I, spoke about last week, and something which, when we talk about this paragraph, we'll bring back in as well, that there is definitely a sense of culmination of all of the beautiful aspects of Midbar that come to a close in Sefer, in Parshat Maaseh, and in these last two paragraphs, well, not Ari Miklat, I don't think there's any really positive side of Ari Miklat, but also in the last piece, the last paragraph of the Parsha, we'll talk about how really there perhaps is very clearly a sense of, again, of doom and of ending on this reality of Bein HaMitzarim, of the 3 weeks of Gimel Deporanuta, of Korban, that comes out through the end of Parshat Maaseh. So now we, I think, have legitimately dealt with numbers 1 through 6. While the open question is, and I don't have an answer yet, I hope to have one by the time we learn together Bamidbar and the Midrashah, but I don't have an answer yet, why we need to go through every single journey in one pasuk, 4 or 50 pasukim, I don't know. But the Bamidbar aspect on a certain level wraps up in part one, and then all of the issues of the rise of the individual, of the uniqueness of the individual, the connection between the individual and Makom, the goal of getting to Eretz Yisrael, of building a reality of a Makom Shechinah, Hashra'at HaShechinah in Eretz Yisrael, all of that's coming to a close here, even through the Ari Miklat, which are focusing on the incredible uniqueness of each individual life and the preciousness of each individual life within the context of Klal Yisrael.
Maybe the first part of all the journeys is going to foreshadow Sefer Dvarim. I mean, like, it's the ends of Sefer Bamidbar going into Sefer Dvarim.
I see it foreshadowing all of this. It does, on a certain level, definitely foreshadow Sefer Devarim, but it's got to be more than that as the opening. It has to conclude Sefer Bamidbar. It also has to plant the seeds. We always have seen in all the previous Sfarim where the seeds are definitely planted for the other Sfarim. We'll talk about it. That'll actually link into number 7, but I think we need more than that. Okay. So the last thing we have to deal with is this last paragraph, right? We can almost even, 26 minutes in, we can even make a clear break. We've dealt with, the kind of way in which Sefer Bamidbar wraps itself up and comes to a close within the majority of Parshat Maaseh. We're having a clean break here, and now we're going to really focus in on the issues surrounding the final paragraph, the final chord of Sefer Bamidbar and Parshat Maaseh, which is the discussion of what to do. Again, the way that it frames it here in the shoulder caption, the way that we've been calling it, which is intermarriage between the Shvatim. So what is this story, which Sima put as the other half of the Benot Slavchad, which is, again, I think very much how we think of it, and we'll talk about that that's a big part of it. So in the concluding and wrapping up paragraph of all of Sefer Midbar, the heads of Mishpachat B'nei Gilad, of Shevet Menashe, go to speak with Moshe. So why are they speaking to Moshe? What's their problem? What is their issue? So previously in Parshat Pinchas, the Benot Slavchad, who are also from Mishpachat Gilad, of Shevet Menashe, they're told, meaning they come and they say, listen, our father deserves a chelek in Eretz Yisrael, but he didn't have any sons. He only had daughters, and we, his daughters, come to you, and we demand that our father should have a chelek in Eretz Yisrael, should have a makom in Eretz Yisrael. Right? And it comes in Parshat Pinchas, where the second sentence is, everybody's being counted. Everybody who's here deserves to go in. We deserve to go in, and if we deserve to go in, we deserve a makom. And Moshe goes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes back and says, they're right. And in a case where a father only has daughters, then the daughters do in fact inherit the father's land, and they get his inheritance in Eretz Yisrael. Come along, the B'nai Menashe, and they say, whoa, hold up for a second. That's very nice. And the Benot Slavkot are very sweet people. Really, they're wonderful, and B'shatva Mutzlachat, they should find their Zivug, and we're very happy for them. However, right? It's one of the few times you're going to hear a however after that sentence, right? However, we have a problem with them getting married. Because if this whole ending of Sefer Midbar is all about, what the whole thrust of Sefer Midbar is all about, is that you have to get our own individual, unique Makom Nachala in Eretz Yisrael. When they go and marry, if they marry a man from a different Shevet, then that land, which previously belonged to Menashe, is now going to transfer over to the Shevet of their husband.
Interesting.
That's Pshat Psukim here. That's what's happening, right? And that's their issue. And they said, it's not fair. We get a unique Nachala in Eretz Yisrael. We want to keep that Nachala, and it's not fair. It's not right. It's not right. It's not even an issue of fair. It's Elo Emet. This is our Chelek. This is our Chelek of Eretz Yisrael. And it can't be that we're going to get our chelek is going to be lessened because they're getting married to somebody else. And you know what? HaKadosh Baruch Hu agrees. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, true, so the halacha still stands that if a man only has daughters, that his daughters inherit that land, and they can marry anybody they want, but, this is a new one for a Shidduch resume, but they can only marry somebody from their Shevet, and that guarantees that the Shevet will remain within the chelak of that, excuse me, that the nachala will remain in the context of that Shevet. And that's the concluding psukim here, and the concluding psukim of Sefer Bamidbar as a whole. Take a look inside. Pasuk Vav, Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Vav. We'll read the end of these psukim. We'll be coming back to them. Zeh Adavar Asher Tziva Hashem Libnot Slavchad. This is what Hashem commanded to Benot Slavchad. Lemor. Latov b'nehem tiyena l'nashim. They can get married to whoever they want. Ach, but l'mishpachat matei avihem tiyena l'nashim. But only to somebody from their same shevet. And again, the point here being because v'lo tisov nachala livnei Yisrael mimatei el matei. Because no portion of Klal Yisrael should go around from shevet to shevet, from matei to matei. Because each one needs to cling to the portion that was given to their fathers. And therefore, anybody or any woman who inherits land, they have to marry somebody from within their own shevet. So they ensure that everybody inherits the land that was given to their forefathers. And again, reiterating, so that way no portion should travel from one mateh to another mateh. Acher, ki ish b'nachalato yidbeku, each person should cling to their nachala, matot b'nei Yisrael. And therefore, and then we see it even playing out, meaning a fulfillment of that very demand, of that very command. Kasher tziva Hashem at Moshe, just like God commanded Moshe, kein asu b'not slavchad, they did this. We even get the end of the story. Vatiyena machla, tirtza, v'chagla, umilka, v'noa, all of the daughters of Tzlofchad, v'not Tzlofchad, li v'nei dodayhen l'ashim, they all got married to the sons of their uncles, to their cousins. Mishpechot b'nei Menashe ben Yosef, hayu l'ashim v'ti nachalatan al matem mishpachat avihen, and therefore it made sure that their inheritance, their portion, remained within their shevet. And that's how B'Midbar comes to a close. Now, there are a few questions that arise from this. First of all, why is the story even here? What is this whole story doing here? The story begins, as we said before, the story begins in Parshat Pinchas. It would have made a lot more sense for, as Sima put it, the other half of the story of the Benot Tzlofchad to be in the story of the Benot Tzlofchad. Then we wouldn't have to call it the other half of the Benot Tzlofchad story. It would just be where it's supposed to be. It would be one story. It's the conclusion of the same story. Why does the Torah divide the story into two parts and then transplant the second part over here? And chronology is not a good answer. The Torah is never concerned with chronology over theme. So what is it doing over here? Give me the whole story in one place over there. Clearly, Torah feels compelled on a narrative level to break up the story for the purpose of putting the second half here to make this the final chord of Sefer Bamidbar. So if this is true, why is the story the final chord of Sefer Bamidbar? In what way does this wrap up the entirety of the Sefer with all of its intended goals and all of its underlying themes? Now, again, we've foreshadowed this with the first half of the shir that we gave. I mean, you can already see so many of the themes really coming to a close in that paragraph. The story encompasses everything that Sefer Bamidbar set out to accomplish. It's about each individual and each shevet having their own unique identity that needs to be dignified and maintained. It's about each shevet with their unique identity having their own unique makom. This paragraph is all about maintaining that identity and that makom and guaranteeing that it remains true, that it remains part of their identity and their makom for all generations. Meaning this paragraph is about not just that every individual and every shevet has their place. It's ensuring that that place remains my place, doesn't get lost, doesn't get subsumed, that that's my place for all generations. That this is the nachala of Shevet Menashe for all generations. That the unique identities within Eretz Yisrael are maintained for all generations. It's about the uniqueness of the individual, the uniqueness of the Shevet, the uniqueness of the Makom, and establishing that, and making sure that nothing changes. It's establishing the goal of Sefer Midbar as the unique individual, as being maintained for all generations going forward. The story seems to be clearly transplanted here because it is a true wrapping up of so many of the themes, so many of the goals of what Sefer Bamidbar is about. I mean, even in the fact that we then identify the names of the Benot Tzlafchad, again, which we already identified by name also very oddly, we almost never do such a thing in Chumash. We identify the names of the Benot Tzlafchad in Pinchas. We then again here name them by name and say that each individual found her Zivug and then each one settled down and v'chule, like, again, this focus on the individual, but the individual maintaining their reality and their makom. Here's where things get really interesting and where we're going to sort of blow the doors off of everything, I hope. I'd like to share with you how my Rebbe originally concluded this shiur, and then how we together reframed it and switched it in a conversation that we had last week to add very different layers to the way that he originally concluded this shiur. Okay? The way that my Rebbe originally concluded the shiur was as follows. He said, however, and he did, even when I was on the phone with him, I was listening to a shir from 10 years ago, so he didn't know that I remember that I had just listened to a shir from 10 years ago yesterday, so he was reiterating the points, and he literally went over this very same piece with me when we were talking it out on the phone first. So he said that the story actually doesn't end here. There is an historical continuation of this story of the Benot Tzlafchad that goes beyond the end of Sefer Bamidbar, and that's only revealed at the conclusion of Masechet Ta'anit. Anybody know what the conclusion of the story of Benot Tzlafchad is? The conclusion of the story of tribal intermarriage? Of intermarriage between the Shvatim?
Well, it stopped being a rule after a while.
When?
Tuvah.
Excellent. So, says the Mishnah in the Gemara Masechet Ta'anit, that six things happened on this very mysterious day of Tu B'Av. Six things. The Mishnah tells us that there were lo hayu yamim tovim. I think I have the quote in front of me. I'm sorry, you don't have the quote. Lo hayu yamim tovim li Yisrael kechamishasar ba'av el chiyom ha-kippurim. There were no yamim tovim, this is the Mishnah there, in the last Mishnah Masechet Ta'anit. There were no yamim tovim in all of Israel like Yom Kippur and Tu B'Av. Says the Gemara. Yom Kippur, I understand. It's a day of Slicha and Mechila. Against the modern day understanding of our relationship with Yom Kippurim, it's actually very much a day of joy. It is not a day of fire and brimstone and horror and negativity and endless shul that we only want to run out of. It's supposed to be a day where we're angels and we're standing there before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's a beautiful day of Slicha and Mechila. It's a day of joy. It's genuinely a day of joy. So says the Gemara, so I understand why this day is a day of joy. But what's Tu B'Av? What is this Tu B'Av? So the Gemara then goes and says, gives six things that happened on this day that clearly must all be different facets of one reality. And that Gemara on Ta'anit Daf Lamed Amud Bet and Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, the end of Masechet Ta'anit, needs to be understood and thought about, and how do these six pieces come together? But six things happen that make this day of joy, and very clearly, somehow, if it's a few days after Tisha B'Av, somehow a tikkun for the destructive nature of Tisha B'Av. Which we can already sort of even feel out based on our discussion so far. When we talk about the roots of Tisha B'Av, the roots of Tisha B'Av go back all the way to where? Chet HaMeraglim. And when we looked at Chet HaMeraglim and we incorporated Pesukim and Sefer Devarim, what was really at the heart of Chet HaMeraglim? What was really the big problem at the heart of Chet HaMeraglim? Their worldview of?
Israel.
Of what?
Israel.
What was the key word there? The pasuk from Devarim, from this week's Parsha, B'sinat Hashem Otanu Otzianu Mi'aretz Yisrael, that God took us out of Mitzrayim from a place of hate. That they had this destructive worldview of seeing a whole worldview, a god of hate, or a history of hate. And so then what somehow is Tu B'Av going to be surfacing, which we know Tu B'Av is about on some level? Ahava and love. Connectedness, you being united, being one, connectivity. And so, unsurprisingly, one of the things identified as being what happens on Tu B'Av is that this very decree was immediately overturned once they got into the land. And the Chazal or Doresh from the Pesukim that we just read, when it says Zeha Davar Asher Tziva Hashem Lebenot Shlofchad, this is the thing that he commanded for Bnot Shlofchad. Zeh Davar Zeh Lo Yeh Noheg Ela Bedor Zeh, that this is only for this generation. Learns that from the word Zeh Al Pi Torah Sheba Al Peh. Good luck. Feed the bodies of the Jewish people as well. So the Zeh is focused on that it's only for this generation, and that for all future generations already once they're the Lamb, then suddenly they allowed. That was one of the things that created joy on Tu B'Av. Because again, relating to this clear theme of Tu B'Av, of being the opposite of hate, but leading to a reality of love and connectedness and unifying and joining together, building, bringing back all of the tribes of Klal Yisrael to one, that this decree was overturned, this halacha was switched. And we have a reality where now they can marry one to another. At that point in history, for all future generations, no longer if a daughter inherits her father's land is she only allowed to marry within her shevet, but rather she can marry anybody she wants, and in Achinam, yeah, so the Nachalot can travel amongst each other. Somehow creating a more unified reality amongst Klal Yisrael. So Rebbe in that shir from 10 years ago quoted a piece from Rav Kook, where he says, how is it possible, you know, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that asks what happens to the 10 lost tribes, the 10 lost shvatim. And one opinion is that the 10 shvatim are never going to come back, that they're totally lost, they're totally gone. He says, how is that possible? How is it possible the 10 of the building blocks of what Klal Yisrael are about are lost and are never going to come back? How can such an opinion exist? So Rav Kook evidently says in that piece, he didn't quote where the piece was, I haven't seen the piece inside. But evidently Rav Kook says in that piece, no. Because once we have Tu B'Av, and once we're allowed to marry in between Shvatim, then every single person in Klal Yisrael carries within them the genes of the totality of Klal Yisrael. Then the Shvatim are not limited by their own Shvatim, the Shvatim all carry the other Shvatim within them. Not in a way that loses the goal of Bamidbar, which is the individual identity, but in a way where that identity is maintained, but incorporated in the more broad identity that I have, is also the other Shvatim as well.
Except for Cohen and Levi.
Who still exist.
Right.
Who we still have. That's the point. In Yisrael exists all of Yisrael. And Cohen and Levi exist still on their own. And so what he wanted to point out there is almost like the concluding of the story is that Sefer Midbar is setting out to create the reality of the individual, but the real goal was to get not just to hear, but to take it one step further in Masechet Ta'anit with Tu B'Av, come to a place of really respecting the reality of the individual, but within the context of the whole, and where we all carry a piece, where individuals will all carry a piece of everybody else. My issue with this conclusion is that it's not the conclusion of Sefer Midbar. If anywhere in the end of the Pesukim here, it mentioned Tu B'Av, it mentioned there was... It's all in that one little word, Zeh. That's not clear from the text. That's not the end of the story. That's not the end of Sefer B'Midbar. Somehow that's actually a tikkun for the brokenness of the end of Sefer B'Midbar, but it's not in the context of Sefer B'Midbar. So what's going on here? What is this conclusion? What's happening here? Why is it ending on this broken note of leaving it separated in a way where one generation later, when we inherit the land, immediately we get rid of this decree because something is so wrong and broken about this decree? So it was at this point that my Rebbe shared with me, and then we developed whatever little chelak I had in that, a mind-blowing perspective on what the word Bamidbar means and how it and we discussed how it wraps up the Sefer in a whole different way. Ready for this? Let's do this together. I still don't have this 100% clear. It's all brand new, literally brand new. So work through it with me together. On the one hand, you have this reality of Bamidbar. Bamidbar is a reality of this desert we talked about before. It's a reality of a desert. Inside of the word Bamidbar is another word, which we haven't talked about. And that word is Midaber or Dibor, the root of Dibor. The question is, what is the relationship? Is there a relationship between Dibor and the Midbar? And Dibor, speech, and the entirety of Sefer Bamidbar? So first of all, the answer is definitely yes. Whatever the relationship may be, the answer is definitely yes. Dibor underlies the entirety of the Sefer. I think. So does my Rebbe clearly think so. From the issues in Parshat Shlach, where broken speech is what leads to Chet HaMeraglim, to the Machloket in Parshat Korach, to the issues of speaking to the rock versus hitting the rock in Parshat Chukat, to issues of Bracha and Klala, speaking Bracha and curse in Parshat Balak, where even the miracle in the context of that story is that a donkey starts to talk. Speech is constantly coming out again and again. We talked about last week, Nedarim is one of the ways that the Sefer comes to a close in the beginning of Parshat Matot. Speech is very clearly an underlying theme. And even earlier than that, remember we talked about in previous discussions how the day of Hakamat HaMishkan, where the day that the Mishkan goes up, is dealt with differently in Shmot, Vayikra, and Bamidbar, that day of Aleph Nisan of the second year. The conclusion of that is after all of the Nisi'im in Parshat Naso, they all bring their unique Korban, and the Mishkan comes up, the way that it describes the Mishkan going up, the way it describes Hashrat HaShchinah in this Sefer specifically, isn't that a cloud comes into the Mishkan, isn't with all of the fanfare of Nadav and Avihu and what was going on there in Sefer Vayikra. Here it's that Moshe walks into Ol Moed and hears God speaking from between the Kruvim. But speech is very much seems to be underlying Sefer Bamidbar. How does this speech fit in? What's the connection to Mibar? So he proposes as follows. That what Chumash HaPikudim produces is the reality of the individual. Chumash HaPikudim produces the reality of the individual. That's the goal. I'm an individual. And because I'm an individual, because I'm unique, because I'm my own destiny, I'm my own person, I'm unique into myself, I need my own makom. I need my own makom. But what that also creates is the first time that we have divisions between all of Klal Yisrael. Meaning, where are we coming from? We're coming from Har Sinai. Har Sinai, where we are, ki ish echad, belev echad. We're all united, we're all one, there are no distinctions, there are no divisions. We come here and now I get my individual identity, my individual unique person, my unique space, my unique makom. But what inherently happens when you give somebody a unique makom is that I have my makom and you have your makom. And you have your makom and you have your makom. Everybody has their own makom. But what that creates is that what rises out of that is that there's now space between me and you. It creates a reality where there is space, that midbar, that empty space between myself and the other. And where previously we were all unified in one, we were living at Har Sinai in a reality of Ein Od Milvado, that's the reality of Har Sinai, clear clarity, God, everybody's unified, it's all one. Now there's me and there's you and there's the space between us, and now what do I need? What's the problem? What arises now? What's necessary now? If I'm here and I have my own unique identity and thoughts and my own self and I'm over here and you're over there, what now needs to happen? What needs to rise?
Communication
and speech. Individuality creates the necessity of speech to communicate from my makom and my individual identity to your unique individual identity and your makom. That midbar that comes out, that empty space that comes out between those mikomot, gives rise for the necessity of speech. Bein adam lechaviro. But as an aside, it also, for that matter, gives the necessity of the rise or the need for the rise of speech between bein adam L'makom. At Har Sinai again, Ein Od Milvado. We're all seeing God. We're seeing these crazy sights and this insanity of all that's going on when we're at Har Sinai. Clarity. All seven heavens open up. Now in my own makom, my own work, my own space, there's also, I have my makom and somehow now more distinct. And I'm separate from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so too, the need for a rise in speech between myself and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And what we see happen over the entirety of the course of Sefer Bamidbar, this is where I would suggest, where I would claim, though Rav Amos was very excited about this possibility, is that what we see is we see the rise of the makom, and we see the rise of the individual and the individual space. All of that successfully comes to its conclusion by the end of Bamidbar. And the need for speech is also created in Bamidbar. But what does Bamidbar fail to do? It fails to produce good speech. What it produces is the need for speech and then the emergence of very, very broken speech. Totally distorted speech. Our inability to fill that void properly. God tries to set the stage by having his voice come through the Kruvim when we come together in the Machaneh Shechinah in the end of Parshat Naso. But we go into Parshat Ba'alotcha and already everything goes off the rails. We're fighting and yelling and screaming and arguing with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, and then we're Chetam Araglim, there's a Dibara'a on the Aretz, and then there's Machloket and Korach, and then there's issues of speaking to the rock versus hitting the rock, and then there's Bracha and Klala, and then all the speech totally gets into a destructive place. Meaning, we successfully create the divisions between us. The unique identity that arises from the divisions between us. Chumash HaPikudim is successful. It's successful. We each are unique. Our Shevet is unique. Manakom is unique. The Bamidbar is successful. We get through the desert with a new identity. We're the Dor Ba'ei Haaretz. We're ready to go into the land. And we each have our own Makom. And there is spaces between us. There is a Midbar between us. But the area in which Bamidbar fails, which ultimately leads to our destruction, is that we are incapable of producing fixed, proper, good speech. That's where this ends. This ends not just about each Shevet arguing that we need to maintain my space. It's almost a fight between them. This is my space, this is my reality, this is my Makom. And I don't want anybody, even marriage, even love, nothing should be able to get in the way of my space being maintained. We'll cut off communication from the other Shevet. We'll cut off the ability to get married. But we need to maintain that space. That's where it ends. That's the conclusion of Sefer Bamidbar, because we're not able to metakin speech. So Bamidbar comes to a close, and Chumash HaPikudim comes to a close. But that underlying need for Dibur doesn't come to its conclusion. Which is why I started to jump inside. There was somebody waiting to talk to me. I feel so bad. There was somebody who waited for 45 minutes. She has a beautiful neshama. She waited for me for 45 minutes because I was on the phone with the Ramos, and she sat and waited to talk to me for 45 minutes. I feel so bad. But this is all in her school, so we wouldn't have gotten to this. So I'm sitting there in the basement in the closet so that way I'm not disturbing anybody, and I'm talking to him on the phone with the recorder next to the phone so I get everything onto it. Sitting there, and I start jumping up and down in this closet. Start jumping up and down. Because it answers a question that's always bothered me for a long time, which how could it be that not one, but two books of Chamisha Chumshei Torah, two books, have their root in the words Dalet Bet Resh. What's the second book?
Devarim.
And what is Sefer Devarim? Sefer Devarim is going to produce a tikkun of the Dibor that wasn't fixed in Bamidbar. That's why Bamidbar leads into Devarim. Bamidbar gives rise for the need for Dibur underneath the surface. It's hidden within the word Bamidbar. It gives the need for the rise of Dibur, which fails to happen in Bamidbar. And Bamidbar comes crashing to a conclusion in the middle of the 3 weeks in a place of destruction, in a discussion that comes from Sinat Chinam, divisions between people, a lack of ability to connect, a lack of unity amongst Klal Yisrael. Which only proper Dibor and unity and unification can come out through a tikkun in Sefer Devarim, another Sefer with the same root, but actually addressing strictly the issue of Dibor. Addressing specifically the issue of speech. At which point Rav Amos jumps in and says as follows, that works amazingly with what we said before. I said, what was that? He said, here's how it fits in. You said that your issue was that this story comes to a conclusion not in Sefer Midbar. So one of the reasons is because, I would claim, is because it has to end in a place of Chorban, a Chorban of speech. Where does the tikkun of speech then take place? It takes place in Tu B'Av, which is in, takes place cycle of year-wise in Sefer Devarim. And is what Sefer Devarim is very much all about, and we'll talk about that when we learn Sefer Devarim together in the spring. But it takes place in Torah Sheba'al Peh. We're dorish from the word zeh. We come back around and using Torah Sheba'al Peh, using a fixed speech of speaking out Torah, of learning out Torah, of Torah Sheba'al Peh, that's where the tikkun comes and then creates a reality of tikkun, of saying, yes, that's in pshat, that's what happened, but Torah Sheba'al Peh, with fixed dibor, that's where we then prove that we have to unify as one Klal Yisrael. And that's why that story comes to a close, not in the pshat. The tikkun has to exist in the context of Torah Sheba'al Peh. It has to be dorish from a pasuk. It has to exist in the Gemara. That's its place. Because tikkun, the Dibor isn't metakin here, it's tikkun, it's metakin over there. It's metakin in the context of Torah Sheba'al Peh. And metakin in a time of the year which takes place during Sefer Devarim, which, again, we'll talk about more at another point, which in and of itself is, in the sense that if you already hear this, is also a book very much it's all about Torah Sheba Al Peh, as Moshe Rabbeinu speaks out the whole Sefer. A lot of the Sforim talk about how Torah Sheba, how somehow the roots of Torah Sheba Al Peh are very much in Sefer, are in Sefer Devarim. That was something I was really excited last week, and that's what I'm really excited to share with you for the first time this week. So I suspect that this is how everything wraps up. That really Parshat Maaseh from beginning to end is wrapping up all of these themes of Sefer Bamidbar, Chumash HaPikudim, Rise of the Individual, the necessity of Makom, the Midbar aspect of creating something new, and needing to deal with that, and also creating the spaces between people, but that the only thing that it doesn't fix, which is why it ends in a place of the 3 weeks. Also, by the way, this is super new. I just was thinking about this earlier today. That meaning I keep calling it the 3 weeks. It's always the problem when you use clunky English terms. What is it really called? Bein Hamitzarim, confined space. Confined space. I suspect that maybe it ends during Bein Hamitzarim because we're in all of these individual borders and boundaries and not letting things come through, and that pushes us together, it forces us into a place of tsa'ar when we allow ourselves to be boxed in that way. When we create a reality where each shevet is boxed in and cut off from the other shvatim in that way. But bringing out also issues of Bamidbar and even issues of Dibor, not to its tikkun, but unfortunately to its kilkul. But setting the stage for, on the positive side, the rise of the individual, which is very much what Sefer Bamidbar was set out to accomplish, and it did. And having our own unique Makom in Eretz Yisrael, and something which we need to embrace and celebrate is the uniqueness of every single individual in the Shema in Klal Yisrael, and the preciousness of every single person in Klal Yisrael, the preciousness and uniqueness of every single Shevet, the preciousness and uniqueness of every single Makom that we have, and that we have everything that we need to do our Avodat Hashem, and the Avodat Hashem that only we can do in the Makom that we are in, and there's no other way to look at it. That's who we are, that's what we are, that's what we're given, and that's something which is celebrated by Sefer Bamidbar. The capacity that Bamidbar gives us to totally reinvent ourselves if we choose to become something new, if we're willing to go into the wilderness of self. We can produce a new reality for ourselves that can be totally different than what came before. We can produce a whole new generation internally that's ready for new heights of Avodat Hashem and new places to inherit like Eretz Yisrael. But also reminds us of the dangers of being too distant from the other. Of totally cutting ourselves off from the other. The kilkul that can bring out by ending in Bein HaMitzarim, by leading to Tisha B'Av, by leading to a place where there's a Korban HaBayit because of Sinat Chinam. From broken speech, from an inability to relate, from an inability to unify, and at least plant the seeds for that to sprout up, Bezrat Hashem, as we go forward this week throughout Sefer Devarim. I want to thank all of you for participating literally right here with us. Some of you who have been participating singularly over the internet, some of you who have participated half here and half over the internet and have come back from Eretz Yisrael and are joining us again. It's really, really been a fun journey. Parshat Maaseh, it's been a fun journey with all of you to explore Sefer Midbar, something which Sefer I've never really had any clarity on whatsoever. I don't claim to have clarity yet now, but I at least have things to work with, and I hope we all do. And look forward to continuing to learning with you here and abroad as we retread, as we go over Sefer Midbar, Bezrat Hashem, over the course of the school year in the Midrash. Shkoach, everybody.